Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Well, that was depressing, wasn't it? The news this morning that not only did the economy not add any jobs last month, it lost a whole bunch more than we thought it would. And that, by the way, is just a headline number. Wait until we dig a little bit deeper for you. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Friday. This one is the 8th of January. And the headline numbers go something like this. The economy had 85,000 fewer jobs at the end of December than it did at the beginning. The unemployment rate stayed steady at 10%. But what you may not be aware of is that unemployment statistics come in a whole lot of different flavors. There are the regular unemployed, the marginally attached worker. Remember, this is government terminology we're dealing with here. Also, there are discouraged workers as well. And when you add all of them together, today's unemployment report tells a whole nother story. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has more.
As the Great Recession drags on, the number of unemployed workers who've given up looking for a job is rising. Throw in part-time workers who'd rather be full-time, and the underemployment rate in December was 17.3%. That's just below the all-time record last October. But Kate Bronfenbrenner, a labor professor at Cornell University, says an untold number of jobless people are never reached by the government's telephone surveys.
It's especially true of immigrant families, urban communities, where you have multiple adults with one phone number. What I think it tells us that we have a serious crisis in this country.
Clifford Varner is one of those long-term unemployed who doesn't show up in the official statistics. He's an information technology consultant in San Diego.
We've listened to these numbers and laughed because the numbers are sourced upon those individuals who get themselves on the books as being unemployed. Anyone who's been self-employed like myself, we don't go down to the unemployment office to get on the books because we don't qualify anyways.
Varner's consulting contracts began drying up soon after 9/11. He and his wife, Dee Dee, have burned through a second mortgage and maxed out their credit cards, trying to raise their three children with no job.
He's also applied for a custodial position, and he didn't get that job.
The Economic Policy Institute estimates over 800,000 discouraged workers have dropped out of the labor force since the recession began. During that time, population growth should have added nearly 3 million new workers. It'll take a strong economic recovery to absorb the uncounted pent-up demand for jobs. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, as you may know, came to his current job from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And it is in that capacity that the House Oversight Committee would like to have a little chat with him. Lawmakers want to hear more about Mr. Geithner's role in the latest scandal involving the insurance company AIG. Some emails that show the New York Fed asked AIG to stay mum on its payouts to the big Wall Street banks even after AIG got its taxpayer bailouts. The White House said today that Mr. Geithner was not involved in any cover-up, but this news is just the latest thorn in the secretary's side. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports now on why he is getting so much grief.
Critics on the left say Geithner may have worked in government most of his career, but he's too tied to Wall Street. Blogger Arianna Huffington has been hammering him since March. She says he's a good guy.
But if you come from the point of view of putting Wall Street in the center of everything, you make wrong decisions. So that's really all that's happening. It's a real reflection of how he sees the world.
For the right, bashing Geithner's become a campaign tactic. Congressman Rob Simmons is running as a Republican to replace Senator Chris Dodd in Connecticut. He's made Geithner a main issue in his campaign.
You know, he's been accused of being too close to Wall Street. That in and of itself is not a disqualifying factor as long as there's no quid pro quo in what's taking place. But transparency is something that was promised in the election last fall. I don't think there's been transparency in his role as Treasury Secretary.
So not transparent enough, too close to Wall Street. Stanford economist Michael Boskin understands those criticisms, but he says Geithner's not the problem.
He has done some sensible things, and he's adjusted when things haven't worked out, and I give him credit for that.
Boskin served as head of the Council of Economic Advisers under the first President Bush. He says any Treasury secretary would have a tough job right now.
Secretary Geithner came in under very difficult circumstances. The economy was in a deep recession. The financial crisis was at its height, and there's still almost a year later, he's not fully staffed.
The White House said today the president still has full confidence in Timothy Geithner. But it's worth remembering the last two presidents went through three Treasury secretaries each. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
It's mostly a joke, or at least I think it is, when people say Google wants to take over the world. But get this, as if search and cell phones weren't enough, Google has asked federal regulators to let it buy and sell electricity. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
Clicking on a search in Google might not seem like a big use of energy, but behind the scenes, banks of massive computers consume lots of electricity. At the same time, Google has pledged to use cleaner power. In 2007, company leaders said they plan to become carbon neutral.
We're trying really hard to be creative about how we can reduce the carbon intensity of our operations.
That's Google's spokeswoman, Nikki Fenech. She says the ability to trade electricity would give Google
a little more flexibility to explore various renewable energy purchase and sale agreements. That means that we could buy electricity wholesale rather than through a utility. So this is all about us procuring renewable energy for our portfolio.
How much energy does the company need? I asked Jeff Jarvis, the author of What Would Google Do?
Google does not say how many servers it has, but it uses a gargantuan amount of energy in its server farms all around, plus with 22,000 employees, all those offices and computers.
By some estimates, the company uses enough kilowatts to power a medium-sized city. Jarvis says Google has invested $45 million in renewable energy.
Google's interest in energy is a matter of enlightened self-interest. They use so much energy that if they can reduce the cost of it, that will help them on their bottom line, and it will also help their reputation.
Google says it may sell excess renewable energy on the wholesale market. The company doesn't plan to compete with utilities, but at the same time, Google won't rule it out. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Traders on Wall Street seem to brush off today's jobs report. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It was big television news when NBC decided to run Jay Leno 5 days a week at 10 o'clock at night. That means it's bigger news now that the network is thinking about putting him back in his old late night slot for a half an hour and bumping Conan O'Brien's Tonight Show to midnight. But if Leno couldn't bring in the ratings in primetime, what's to say he can bring the magic back just because he's on later? Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
NBC finds itself in something of a Humpty Dumpty-style bind.
This is the big question. Can you, in fact, take a major decision like this and reverse it and hope that everything goes back to normal?
Syracuse University pop culture professor Robert Thompson says there's no real precedent for this. Perhaps the closest threat to NBC's Tonight Show franchise dates all the way back to 1960, when its popular host Jack Parr walked off the show over a censored monologue.
There must be a better way of making a living than this.
The show languished for a month before Parr was persuaded to return.
As I was saying before I was interrupted.
And he did bring his audience back with him, but viewing habits have changed a lot since way back then, as Boston University Communications Professor Chris Cakebread points out.
You have to remember, back in those days, there wasn't much place for the audience to go, right? Now you've got so many places that they can go in terms of cable, just sticking with television, or go onto the computer, and you've lost them totally.
Word is the switch will come after the upcoming Winter Olympics, which gives the network an important opportunity.
One of the great benefits of having major programming like the Olympics, which lasts obviously over a two-week time period, is you get a tremendous increase in viewership to promote their other programming up and coming, but also in this particular case, promoting the time change and putting a real positive spin on their late-night programming changes.
Cakebread believes Leno is popular enough to win back his late-night audience, but Syracuse University's Robert Thompson says simply bumping Conan O'Brien won't necessarily fix things.
One of the reasons he's not doing as well on The Tonight Show is because Leno is not delivering the audiences to the local news, which is then not delivering the audiences to The Tonight Show.
Thompson says Leno's low-rated primetime show might have made him damaged goods. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Welcome, everybody, to the end of the first work week of the new year. How's 2010 treating you so far? All right, it is a bit early for real economic pulse-taking, but that doesn't mean there's been nothing going on. Here for our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond, we have John Carney from ClusterStock.com. Also, Heidi Moore, she writes for The Big Money. Good to talk to you both again.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
Thanks for having us.
We are going to go in roughly chronological order, John, and we're going to start with Christopher Dodd, chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, saying he's not going to run again. Obviously, a very big deal in the world of financial reform, or is it?
I think it is a very big deal. He was going to lose this race, and a Republican was going to come in. That might have shifted some of the tenor of what actually will happen with financial reform. It's now going to be a safe seat for the Democrats again.
Yeah, well, okay, but which is great politically. But what about the idea of financial reform, Heidi?
Well, I think I think that's very funny because what is the idea of financial reform? Does anyone know?
See, there you go. I didn't even know I was being funny on my own show. Anyway, go ahead.
If you look at pragmatically what we need to reform, the people who can actually do that are not Chris Dodd, and they are not in the Senate, and they're not in the Congress. They're Mary Shapiro at the SEC. They're Ben Bernanke. They're Tim Geithner. You know, if we're talking about just kind of a little bit of legislative, you know, moving and shaking, Dodd really, it's a good thing we're putting him out of his misery, you know, because he just was doing this terrible balancing act where he had a constituency of hedge funds, which had nothing to do with his constituency of voters. And, you know, now luckily that's over and we don't have to deal with it in the legislative process.
You're so harsh.
I am, aren't I?
All right. Well, let's progress through the week chronologically. Yesterday, we had this news about Timothy Geithner and emails that he sent when he was the president of the New York Fed to AIG saying, listen, don't tell anybody about some of this stuff you're doing. My question to you guys that we talked about a little bit, Jeremy Hobson did up at the top of the broadcast, is Mr. Geithner's prospects for holding on to his job. Heidi?
He's in the job, right? Obama has already kind of declared his faithfulness to him, and I think that's fair. I think one of the strange things about what's going on with Geithner right now is, at least back then, he kind of went to the banks and said, let's be secret friends. Now they're just friendly, and that's kind of a thing that's changed. So it's embarrassing now, not because we didn't know that that was the case, because I think we all kind of knew it, but you know, just the fact that it comes up in a time when it's politically inconvenient for him to be seen as hiding information. But this was before he was Treasury Secretary.
I'll make a bold call. I think Geithner goes in November just after the midterm elections.
Really?
It would look weak to get rid of him ahead of that. But when the Democrats lose some seats in the midterm elections, Geithner will be one of the fall guys. You have to take somebody out when you start losing seats, and Geithner will be the guy who they take out.
And we will see videotape of President Bush after the 2006 midterms announcing that Donald Rumsfeld was leaving.
Exactly.
I mean, that's exactly what it's going to be.
That is, it's going to be an exact repeat of what we saw back then.
Oh, my. All right. Let's see. Item number three on this list I have in front of me is the jobs number from today. What do we think?
Every month, it seems, we're sitting around hoping the movement we've seen in the stock market will be reflected in the broader economy, and it keeps coming back bad.
Heidi?
Yeah, I think we're lost. I think it's actually a really sad situation, and also I think a tremendous opportunity for some real policy response. Just think about how we're going to try to make that up. You can't make up 7.2 million jobs. So if the government really wants to show off and show what it can do, it would be the creation of jobs and something that's not that ridiculous stimulus bill, but actual funding of industry in a way that people can get back on their feet.
Yeah, let me just ask, though, because somebody surely will be thinking this out there. How are you going to pay for that?
That is a good question. That's why they're in office, and I'm not. there's a lot
Coward.
Of money that's been spilled. I don't know if they have to work around the edges at first or whether it's the creation of a whole new industry. I mean, really, the only thing that ended the Great Depression in some people's minds was World War II. Hopefully, we won't have anything like that, but there has to be some massive sea change to get us back to where we were. And that's where I think the people in Washington could really do a service rather than futzing around with financial reform.
John Carney from ClusterStock.com. Heidi Moore, she writes for The Big Money. Guys, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Thanks a lot.
Coming up, catching up to get ahead.
We tell students, if you can squeak by, we'll promote you to the next grade. If you can squeak by, we'll send you to college even.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials added 11 points today, a tenth of 1%, finished at 10,618. NASDAQ up 17.75%, wrapped up at 2317. The S&P 500 tacked on 3 points, a quarter percent, closed at 1144. For the first week of the new year, the Dow added 1.8%. The NASDAQ grew 2%. The S&P 500 advanced 2.7% this Friday. UPS delivered a stronger fourth quarter profit forecast at the same time as it announced it's cutting 1,800 jobs. Shares of the shipping giant trucked up close to 5%. The improved outlook helped lift shares of rival FedEx by 2.5% today. An analyst downgrade flattened Coca-Cola shares. They lost almost 2%. Bond prices rose. That lowered the yield on the 10-year T-note to 3.84%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on podcasts. You'll find Marketplace, The Morning Report, Marketplace Money, and more, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. Advocates for Highway and Auto Safety release a report on state traffic laws. Organizers say an average of 40,000 Americans were killed each year in motor vehicle crashes over the last decade. The North American International Auto Show gets underway in Detroit. And some people mark National Clean Off Your Desk Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The 124th annual meeting of the American Historical Association is in San Diego this weekend. It's probably not the wildest of conventions, even in good times, but the mood is a bit more somber than usual this time around. It wasn't specifically reflected in today's jobless numbers, but new history PhDs looking for work, most of them are just plain out of luck.
Very few jobs, slim pickings for many qualified people. So
it's just sort of amassing more and more candidates looking for fewer and fewer jobs.
I'm mostly just sort of in whatever I can get and wherever. I just need a paycheck.
I have lots of students who want to do academic history. They want to do environmental history. I'll sit them down and say, yes, it's a great life. It's a great job. I wouldn't change a thing in my own life, but you've got to understand how hard it is.
That was Emily Moore from the College of William and Mary, Jessica Cannon from Rice University, Leslie Hadfield from Michigan State, and Brian Drake from the University of Georgia. Catherine Brooks is the director of the Liberal Arts Career Center at the University of Texas, Austin, and we've called her up to talk about the dismal employment opportunities for liberal arts graduates overall. Catherine, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Good to be here.
As you just heard, there are some folks out there in the liberal arts, history professors specifically, but liberal arts generally, who are a bit worried about their employability. Should they be?
Well, this is a tough job market. You know, back in 1960, about 75% of faculty were full-time tenure. Now it's only about 27%. So if you're getting a PhD in history, this is a tough market.
How come, though? I mean, what is it that's going on that's making, you know, history majors and political science majors less attractive than calculus majors?
Well, I think, you know, we are seeing some changes in higher ed. We are seeing some shift towards more quote-unquote practical degrees, such as business or engineering. And I think it's, you know, you have a headline on your website today that says something about retail adjusting to the new normal. Mm. And I think higher ed is starting to adjust to a new normal as well.
Explain that a little bit.
Well, I think that fields like the liberal arts have always been excellent preparation for the workplace. They've always been a great start to becoming a better communicator, a good thinker, and other skills. But I don't know that the general public always sees it that way. And I think sometimes, and particularly now when money's a little tight, people are saying, hey, I want bang for my buck in higher ed, and I'm not sure what one does with a history major.
What about schools? How are they responding to this? Are they cutting back on the number of, you know, just to keep picking on history for a second, cutting back on history courses and adding more mechanical engineering and, you know, stock portfolio theory courses?
There are fewer tenure track positions available, certainly. In fact, I think the number of tenure track openings for history dropped about 24% this year. And I believe at this conference, something like 15% of the interviews were canceled. So colleges are adjusting. I think what remains to be seen is this sort of a temporary shift due to the economic climate, or is this more of a permanent trend? I think that's what we don't know yet.
Well, take a guess for me. Let me put you on the spot.
Taking a guess, I think liberal arts in particular will need to be more creative in the next 10, 20 years. I think they're going to need to look at a blending more of how do we take this major and apply it to the workplace? How can we train our graduates through internships and other programs to be more valuable to employers?
Not to get all analytical on you here, but it's a little bit like Joseph Schumpeter and the theory of creative destruction, right? That this is what the marketplace wants right now.
Yes, and I think you have to be careful because that's not the goal of liberal arts. It is much more to create a whole person. I liken it to the BASF campaign. BASF talks about we make these various chemicals. We don't make the final product. Well, that's liberal arts. We make the product better. We don't make the lawyer, but we make the lawyer better.
Should we be worried then about a whole generation of lawyers and Wall Street bankers without art history in their background? And
to be honest, yeah. I would worry about that because I think that is the value of liberal arts. It enhances the person. It gives you new ways of viewing a situation. And I'll tell you, it might have helped if some of our leaders of AIG and Wall Street and elsewhere had had a little classics training in their background.
Catherine Brooks, she's the director of Liberal Arts Career Services at the University of Texas, Austin. Her book is called You Majored in What? Mapping Your Path from Chaos to Career. Catherine, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Forget the Ivies and the big-name public universities. Community colleges are increasingly where it's at in higher education. In the face of enrollment cuts and tuition increases, a lot of students are just staying closer to home. People who've lost their jobs are enrolling, trying to start new careers. And minority students, Latinos especially, see community colleges as a good first step. Emily Hanford of American Radio Works has our story.
If you want to find Latino college students, go to your local community college. This is where most of them begin. Community colleges are inexpensive and easy to get into. In fact, you don't apply, you just sign up. That's what Kati Sorto did. Her ultimate goal is a bachelor's degree, but her plan is to spend 2 years at a community college, then transfer.
I'm nervous. I'm just nervous.
It's Kati's first day of classes at Montgomery College, a community college just outside of Washington, D.C. Kati's not sure she's ready for college. She says her high school wasn't very good. She didn't learn much.
All right, so this is EL 101. Everybody in the right place?
Kati's first class is
okay,
English.
Great.
She was placed here based on the results of a test all students take when they enroll. Turns out this is an English as a second language course, which surprises me. Kati was raised in El Salvador, but she's been going to school in the United States since sixth grade. The other students in this class have been in this country a few months, a few years. But when I ask Kati if she thinks she's in the right class, she says yes, it's exactly what she needs.
The people there is with the same condition as me. It's good.
Kati says in all her years in American public schools, she never learned to read or write well in English. Most students who come to community college are not ready for college-level work. More than 60% have to take some sort of non-credit or remedial class.
They're in college buildings, but they're in college buildings taking high school courses.
Northwestern University sociologist James Rosenbaum studies community college students.
It sort of gradually dawns on them that they're not getting credit. But when they learn this, it's a big disappointment.
And many of them drop out. Community colleges typically lose half their students in the first year. Rosenbaum says the problem, especially for minority students from poor communities, is that graduating from high school does not mean they're ready for college.
Students pass high school exit exams, and 3 months later they show up at college and they're told, you're not ready for college-level material.
Was it grammar you wanted to talk about?
Yeah.
This is Kati Sorto's problem. By the middle of her first semester in college, she's struggling to keep up. So she's come to her professor for extra help.
You have good oral English that you draw from when you're writing, but then you have the verb mistakes.
That's my problem.
Kati says she now regrets not working harder in high school. True, her school wasn't very good, but she freely admits she could have done better. And the fact that she didn't do very well puts her at great risk of never getting a college degree, according to sociologist James Rosenbaum. He says high schools aren't pushing students hard enough.
We tell students, if you can squeak by, we'll promote you to the next grade. If you can squeak by, we'll send you to college, even.
It's the irony of the college for all attitude. Anyone, everyone can go to college now. But if everyone can go, and there are community colleges that will take you no matter what your grades or test scores, then why work hard in high school?
Okay, this word is pronounced alternate. Is it with me? How would you clap it?
Kati Sorto made it through her English class and is now in her second year of community college. But she still has several more remedial classes to go before she can start earning credit toward her diploma. At this rate, it will take her at least 4 years to get what she thought would be a 2-year degree. But Kati says she's determined to do it. I'm Emily Hanford for Marketplace.
To learn more about Kati Sorto and to hear a documentary about her and some other Latino college students, go to our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, a problem that Google may not have anticipated when it decided to offer its new cell phone directly to consumers, unlocked, that is, not tied to a specific wireless carrier. What do you suppose customers who are having a problem with or just a question about the phone are going to do? Nobody to call, except the company who sold it to him. PC World Magazine says Google's online support forums are swamped with people looking for help. Email inquiries only, apparently no phone operators standing by for you. It is kind of an interesting dilemma, though. Customer service from a company that's biggest product, that is, search, is given away for nothing. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Friday afternoon. Today, the Dow rose 11 points, a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ added 17 points, 3/4%. The S&P 500 gained 3 points, 1/4%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Ure. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, the perils of job interviews via video web chat.
I would have to make sure I have a note up to the doorbell to tell nobody to ring the doorbell for the next half an hour that I'm in a meeting.
What could possibly go wrong? I'm Kai Rizdahl. We're back here Monday afternoon. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.